You have reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave a question about your hair's worst nightmare after the tone.
Hi, Flora and friends. My name is Ari, and what I want to know is, where did the bubblegum flavor come from?
Hi, this is Ari.
Hey, Ari, this is Flora from Every Little Thing.
Hi, Flora.
So do you chew a lot of gum?
I don't. I used to when I was a kid, but I don't anymore.
However did this question come to you?
So I was actually watching an episode of The Great British Baking Show.
How are you getting that bubblegum flavor?
Bubblegum essence.
And one of the contestants was making eclairs with a bubblegum flavor cream.
I absolutely love candy and sweets, and these are my two favorites.
It just grossed me out so much to think about eating bubblegum flavored anything.
Can't wait to try that bubblegum.
Thank you.
You're not anti-bubblegum flavor, are you?
No, I truly do like bubblegum flavor in bubblegum. I'm not a, well, this is going to, I'm not a swallower when it comes to bubblegum. I don't want to see it in any other food item. Keep your bubblegum ice cream away from me.
How can we help you?
So what I want to know is, what is the bubblegum flavor?
Yes, it is both unmistakable and hard to identify.
Yeah. There's not a bubblegum tree. There's not a bubblegum bush. So I want to know where it came from.
What do you think the flavor is?
So there's something that comes from a beaver's butt.
Did you say a beaver's butt?
Yeah, there's a flavor that comes from like a beaver's anal gland that goes into fruit-flavored items. Look this up. I swear it's true.
I am going to look it up right now. Okay. Castoreum, the strong-smelling creamy orange-brown substance that comes from the glands of a beaver. Certain artificial flavorings like vanilla, raspberry, and strawberry are made from this.
So see, it might just be all castoreum.
You think bubblegum is just the secretion from a beaver's anal gland?
Yeah, like it was the first product really pushed by Big Beaver.
I think we better get to some answers.
Okay.
So before bubblegum flavor was invented, someone had to invent bubblegum.
Bubblegum was invented in Philadelphia.
That's Scott Bruce. He's an expert on things that happened in Philadelphia as the author of a book called It Happened in Philadelphia.
The story takes place most definitely in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
It's the late 1800s and Philly's home to the Fleer Corporation.
A company that originally started by making flavorings and moved into candy and gum.
So they're making chewing gum, not intended for blowing bubbles, and yet
people would buy their chewing gum and try to blow bubbles.
People were trying to bubble before bubbling was a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're uncovering is that there is an innate human desire to bubble. And candy makers recognized this.
The concept of a bubble gum was something that was highly sought after. Anybody knew that if they perfected that particular product, that they were going to have a corner on the market and really do big business at a penny a pop.
So around the turn of the century, Frank Fleer, the CEO of the Fleer Corporation, makes it his mission to summit Bubble Mountain.
He had been working on the concept of a bubblegum for 20 years.
Wow, 20 years working on bubblegum.
Yeah, and he comes up with a promising product.
A yummy, chewy bubblegum that blew a beautiful bubble.
But there's a problem.
The problem was when the bubble exploded on your face, you couldn't get it off except with turpentine. Yeah, it was just a horrible failure in that regard.
Besides the crazy stickiness, the name needed some work.
He called that Blibber Blubber.
Oh, no.
What a terrible name.
No, yeah, horrible. But then again, it was a horrible product, so.
Fleer is unsuccessful. He retires. His son-in-law takes over the company. And the son-in-law puts the bubble quest on the back burner.
He would have loved to have done it, but he thought my father-in-law spent decades on this and didn't get anywhere.
But then on one fateful day, a series of chance events changes the course of bubble history. So the son-in-law is cooking up a batch of gum base for chewing gum.
And he got called to a phone call.
He pokes his head into the office next door and he asks this accountant, this guy Walter Diemer, to watch the pot.
To make sure that it didn't, I don't know, explode.
So Diemer comes in and he looks into this pot and he becomes obsessed with trying to make bubblegum.
Anyway, what did Diemer do before this?
He's an accountant.
Okay.
That's it.
So he looks into this boiling pot and it's like a cauldron that changes his life.
Exactly.
Something snapped in his head and he said, I'm going to try and play with this. And literally did it on his own time in his own kitchen at his own house.
He spends years on this, cooking up prototype after prototype until he makes a breakthrough.
Walter Diemer discovers the key secret ingredient.
What is the secret ingredient to the gum?
I'm going to give you a hint.
Okay.
What do koosh balls, balloons, and fetish fashion all have in common?
Latex.
Yes, latex.
A natural latex.
From the sap of the rubber tree plant.
Diemer comes up with the right rubber mix, and in 1928, he unveils his bubblegum back at Fleer. And people are psyched.
Oh, they were astounded. They were like, this is it, Walter. You're a god.
The company, Fleer, orders up a big batch, and there's another problem.
It was just ugly as could be. It was a very disgusting gray color.
So how did bubblegum get its signature look?
When they went to color it, they realized the only coloring they had in stock was pink. And that is why, to this day, bubblegum is pink. It was the only choice they had on the shelf.
So bubblegum just got created by pure accident and then pure accident.
They did take some initiative on the name, though. They called it Double Bubble.
Oh, Double Bubble was the original bubblegum.
That's right.
So this original recipe for bubblegum, what was the flavor for that?
The flavor of bubblegum was actually difficult to track down. We had to call in the big gums.
You have to realize that the gum industry is a very secretive industry.
This is Bob Boughton, president of Nectel.
We're one of the largest and oldest confectionery and foods consultants in the country.
We talked to Bob along with his colleague, Mauricio.
Okay, so Mauricio Bobadilla, working in the confectionery industry for 27 years, and now ready to talk about bubblegum.
Mauricio and Bob said that every bubblegum maker has their own variation on the bubble flavor, and they keep these formulas under lock and key. Like, they even go to great lengths to limit the number of people inside the company who know the recipe.
A lot of these companies, what they do is very similar to what you see in the soda industry. They'll have people make component A and component B, and then someone else mixes component A with number C. So very seldomly does everybody see the complete formula.
It's only in very rare situations that someone might see the whole recipe. But fortunately, this is one of those situations.
Really?
Mauricio Bobadilla laid eyes on the original double bubble bubblegum formula.
Yes, that's true. And the reason I was able to check that formula out is because I was working in Canada for a company called Concord Confections.
Concord Confections bought Fleer in 1998.
And all the archives that were set in New York City were transferred to Toronto, and that's why I was able to look at all these files and look at the formulations of that flavor.
Mauricio's bosses wanted to try to recreate the original formula of Double Bubble, so they had him look at this typewritten recipe.
If I remember well, it was a piece of paper, all the yellowish. It was in one of the old typing machines, probably one of those that have cursive letters, and that's it.
Oh, I am so excited I could pop.
You know what? I think it's a perfect time to go to the break. You will find out the true flavors of bubblegum when we come back. Okay, before we get to what bubblegum flavor is, Ari, we sent you a learning aid in the mail. Did you bring it?
I did.
Well, you want to open it up?
Okay. This has been driving me crazy for the last few days.
What do you think is in there?
I have no idea. Everybody, oh my God. Oh my God, there's so much bubblegum. The smell is really overwhelming here.
Ari, for the sake of this story, I need you to chew all 300 pieces of that double bubble.
I will chew one piece.
Okay. What notes are you picking up?
Okay. I really feel like strawberry is in there.
You're in the right family. Mauricio says that original double bubble recipe did include fruit flavors, but it wasn't strawberry.
How about watermelon?
You're getting colder. Think about the most indecent fruit.
Banana?
You got it.
Basically, orange and banana and vanilla are probably the three big notes.
Orange, banana, vanilla, and then some really surprising supporting characters.
There will be the cinnamon, clove, and acacia.
Clove?
Yeah, clove.
What? I just get zero clove.
Here's another shocker.
Wintergreen. There is a type of wintergreen component in that formula.
This is wild.
I know, flavors are so weird. Wintergreen is a primary flavor in root beer as well.
Well, I do love root beer.
Would you swallow it?
I would swallow it, yes. That I would swallow.
Fly away. Fly away. Fly away. Fly away.
So that's the story of bubblegum, how it was made, why it's pink, and the potpourri of flavors that make it up.
Yeah, I think you've covered it. I have 299 little pieces of history here. I feel a little unsatisfied with not having the answer to why do I not like it in other foods that I would eat.
Did you have a bad experience?
Well, I did throw up a lot of amoxicillin when I was a child, and amoxicillin is usually flavored with bubble gum for kids. Uh-huh. So that might be it.
If you're looking for answers on why you don't like it, I think you might want to dive back into that amoxicillin incident.
No, can your mind come on a funky flavor ride? Flavors that blows you away. It's your flavor fantasy.
Bubblicious. Bubblicious has the ultimate flavor. It's got the taste you just can't resist.
For the rest of the show, we're going to switch gears to something you chew and swallow. We got a timely question from listener Kiara.
I was wondering why we don't eat turkey eggs.
Hello?
Kiara, perfect turkey day question. So what made you think of it?
Well, we were at my grandmother's house preparing for Canadian Thanksgiving.
It's in October.
Yes, we have Thanksgiving about a month earlier than in the U.S. This year, we decided to make some deviled eggs. And my grandmother was just sort of complaining about how small these yolks are and how long this is taking. And so, you know, I was thinking, well, why don't we use turkey eggs for this? I bet they're bigger. Where could we find some? And nobody seemed to know.
Have you ever seen a turkey egg?
I've never.
Me neither, so we called a bunch of experts. And here's the synopsis. First of all, it's not about flavor. Turkey eggs taste similar to chicken eggs. But chickens are laying machines. They can lay an egg a day. Turkeys cannot compete.
I see.
Also, turkeys are bigger than chickens. They need more room. You have to feed them more. And that means more money. So the reason we don't eat turkey eggs is just a cost thing.
Oh, that makes sense.
So kind of a bland answer, but since it's brining season, we couldn't let you leave without a doggy bag of turkey facts that might change your view of the bird.
Okay.
Kiara, how well do you know turkeys?
I've never really met a turkey.
Well, we're about to get up close and personal.
I'm ready.
Oh, hold on just a minute. Let me see what I can do.
That's turkey biologist and hunter James Dixon. He's known as the Gobfather, and he's author of what's been called the Turkey Bible.
We tried to summarize everything we knew about turkeys, and I think we did a decent job.
James is going to give us our turkey fact appetizer today, and that is, despite the fact that turkeys do not look particularly graceful, the gobblers have elaborate mating dances.
It's designed to impress the hens, and it impresses turkey hunters, too. They will stomp their feet. They'll have their feathers. Their feathers will be puffed out.
Their tail feathers are fanned out, almost like a peacock, and then they make this specific sound.
It's quite an exciting sound when you call one up. Sounds like... And what they're doing, they're popping their feathers, and they're taking a couple of steps, and they're quivering their feathers and making those sounds. And the posture is called strutting.
Does it look like a strut?
Well, I don't know what a strut looks like other than a turkey strutting. It's quite impressive.
I like that. Well, like you sort of see like on planet Earth, like those really fancy birds that like dance around. I guess I don't really think of like regular birds doing something so grandiose to attract mates.
Exactly. So that's our appetizer. Our turkey fact side dish comes from another captain of Team Turkey.
I love turkeys. I love wild turkeys. I love watching them.
This is Laura Erickson, birder and writer, and she says that turkeys have had some powerful celebrities on their side.
Who likes turkeys?
Their most famous advocate was Benjamin Franklin.
Franklin's turkey love surfaced after the founding fathers picked the bald eagle as our national bird.
Adams and Jefferson definitely wanted a symbol of America's machismo and military will.
Franklin wasn't an eagle fan because he said they stole from other birds.
He said it was a bird of very bad moral character and often very lousy.
And you know what bird he didn't think was lousy and of bad moral character?
He said he wished they'd chosen the turkey, which was a true American bird.
And here's the main dish for this turkey buffet. In the early 20th century, thanks to hunting and habitat loss, turkeys were down to an estimated 30,000 individuals across all of America.
They were extirpated most of their range, and there was only remnant populations in a few places.
Biologists started this wild turkey reintroduction program where they would grab turkeys with a net and then move them to a new location. They also beefed up hunting laws, and it worked.
Now, there's, I don't know, 5 or 6 million, something like that.
Wow. So they really, you can just like plop them anywhere and they'll just live.
I've seen them in New York City and on rooftops of tall buildings in downtown Cleveland. They are figuring out ways of surviving.
You know, they're a pretty resilient creature. They've suffered through long times. They can make it in the wild. You know, they're should be America's bird. I agree with Ben Franklin.
Happy belated Canadian Thanksgiving, Kiara.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you.
If you have a burning question you can't get to the bottom of, give us a ring, 833-RING-ELT, 833-RING-ELT.
That wasn't great, but it was all right.
Every Little Thing is produced by Kristen Clark, Phoebe Flanagan, Aaron Reese, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Ian Chillug and Caitlin Kenny are our consulting editors. Dara Hirsch scored and mixed this episode. Goodbye.